and welcome. I am Piers Ridyard, CEO of the decentralized finance protocol Radix, a public ledger entirely focused on bringing DeFi into the mainstream. This is our podcast, The DeFi Download, a show about decentralized finance and all things crypto, where we dive into the details of the projects, assets, and services that are powering the DeFi revolution. Today, I'm joined by Michael O'Rourke, co-founder and CEO of Pocket.network. Pocket allows developers and users to trustlessly access the full API for any blockchain client across a global distributed network of node operators. Michael, thank you so much for coming on our show.
Piers, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
So let's start by just taking us on a journey. Like, what is Pocket like main reason for being, and like, why did it come about?
Yeah, absolutely. So at a high level, Pocket is a middleware protocol that sits in between the user of any application and the blockchain that they're accessing. And what this does is when a user opens an application, they are then accessing a full node that Pocket has incentivized for them to use the application like they normally would every day. And this concept of Pocket incentivizing people to run full nodes for any blockchain is really important. And to kind of understand why this is important, you kind of have to go back in time to really, you know, the beginnings of Bitcoin. And there's a famous saying in the Bitcoin community. It's called, don't trust, verify. Mm. And this really gets at the core of why Pocket is important, because a big reason why a lot of us got into this space is this idea of financial sovereignty, owning my wealth, right? Mm. And when you say don't trust, verify, that's actually run a full node, sync the entire blockchain, the Bitcoin blockchain, and verify that my balance is what the Bitcoin blockchain says it is, as opposed to what my bank says it is, or whoever it might be. So this is kind of the most important ideal as to why Pocket exists. Mm. And a big reason behind this, you know, back then, right, you had to run a Bitcoin full node to even access the Bitcoin blockchain, right? If you've ever run like a Bitcoin QT client or whatever it might be, frankly, it's difficult. You have to be technically proficient. Back then, it wasn't expensive because Bitcoin was a small blockchain at the time, but you still had to be pretty technical to, you know, run a Bitcoin full node. And in fact, you know, that's actually why Coinbase exists today. Brian Armstrong was like, wow, it's hard to run full nodes. Let me build a wallet that removes the need for my users to have to run full nodes. Mm. Right. And that's kind of, you know, that kind of time was kind of the first departure from, you know, don't trust, verify, because at that point, users are not running their own full nodes, but they're trusting Coinbase.com to run the full nodes for me.
Let's unpack that a little bit. Let's unpack the, like, what do we mean by a full node? Like, what's a full node on Bitcoin?
Yeah. So a full node, the word blockchain, right? It's a full node downloads every block in say the Bitcoin blockchain. And in that block, in those blocks, the state changes or the balances or the ledger is recorded every time I download a block. And at its fundamental core, it's a peer-to-peer network. So I'm downloading these blocks from hundreds or thousands of full nodes that also have this information. So it's, you know, at its core, it's really no different than, you know, if you've ever used like a torrenting system or anything like that, you're kind of just downloading from peers, other people running that same full node. And that's kind of part of how that integrity of verification is ensured, because you kind of have this shared security amongst everyone who also has the same data, right?
So the full node is basically, I own the complete history of the ledger to date, or I have in my direct possession the complete history of the ledger to date. And when you say like, don't trust, verify, what is the universe of things that a user or developer would want to be verifying rather than trusting the network?
Yeah. So my balance, the history of transactions, Keeping it simple, really, like, fundamentally, Bitcoin is just, you know, what's my balance and what's the history of my transactions, right? There's also kind of recently this kind of balance gate, if you will, on Ethereum, right? Where it's actually quite difficult to verify the balance of the Ethereum blockchain, right?
Right.
For
ETH specifically.
For Ethereum, correct. Whereas, you know, Bitcoin makes it very simple where, you know, just, you know, you can just one command and you get the supply, right? And that's a big, you know, that's a huge reason why Bitcoin is important as well, just philosophically, right? And so, you know, very simply, you know, you would want to run your full node to ensure that your balance is what the blockchain says it is. A really interesting, you know, issue behind this is, you know, if I'm sending Bitcoin, right, it wouldn't be too difficult. You know, thankfully, we have trusted companies like Coinbase. And to be fair, we wouldn't be where we are today without them.
Right.
But, you know, what if they put in a different address of who you're sending money to without you noticing, right?
Well, they couldn't do that. They couldn't do that because you have to cryptographically sign the transaction with your private key, in which you need to have the public address for which you're sending funds. You can't say to someone, "Oh, send to," like, if I'm given an address, and I submit a transaction to the Bitcoin network, a node can't then swap out that address for another address. It's cryptographically impossible for them to do, because what I've done is I've signed the transaction request with the specific information, including the recipient.
Correct. But I'm trusting Coinbase to show me the correct address that I'm sending to before I sign it. Right. So that would be a kind of a straightforward man in the middle attack where, you know, swap out the UI of the address I'm sending to, right?
Right.
You know, back in the ICO days, this was a very common attack where, you know, So that's when I say, you know, once you sign and send it, which is why you want to run your own full node, you know, you're running it locally on your computer.
Yeah.
There's no one that can kind of get in the middle of that and kind of change that, that address, for example, right? So that kind of goes into the whole, you know, don't trust, verify. But since then, the industry has moved forward, and frankly, you know, we've needed this, right? I mean, we've definitely reached a modicum of some popularity around the world as an industry, and that's because it's really truly improved the user experience, right? And part of the issue here is that, you know, if I'm running my own full node, great, you know, I can handle, you know, it can handle my own browsing, my own wallets, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You know, I could even run a full node for my family, right? And a full node would be more than capable of handling that kind of traffic.
What would that be? What would that be data-wise? Like, what would I need? How much data do I need to store to run a full Bitcoin node today or a full Ethereum node today?
Oh gosh, yeah. A full Ethereum node is somewhere, I mean, this is part of the debate, but if you're actually downloading the entire state of the Ethereum blockchain, you're looking at like a terabyte and a half or something like that. I think Bitcoin is, last I checked, around 800 gigs or something along those lines. So it's expensive to run a full node. And, you know, the issue is that these full nodes, you know, now that we kind of have this architecture where, okay, I'm using Coinbase's full nodes. Now Coinbase has to make sure that everyone can access those full nodes. And part of the problem is that these are peer-to-peer networks. These are not kind of sophisticated databases that can support web scale applications.
Right.
And as a result, Coinbase might have to run two full nodes for every 1,000 people, as an example, right?
Why? What is Coinbase doing that requires two full nodes per 1,000 people? What's the load on from the user that's creating that requirement?
So imagine I'm refreshing my page for, you know, I made a transaction on the Bitcoin blockchain and I want to make sure that the transaction went through.
I'm sure no one's ever done that.
So I would say a bulk of these requests, right, is reading data from the blockchain, right? And you know, whether it's, you know, making a trade, right, and making sure that, you know, that information gets through so that I can get to the next one. You can see, you know, and the thing is, every time I refresh, right, that is, you know, dozens of requests that are going to a Bitcoin or an Ethereum full node, for example. And when you have thousands and thousands of people doing the same thing at the same time, you know, any full node for one of these blockchains is woefully unprepared for this. So as a result, these companies have kind of fallen back to Web2 solutions, which are tried and true and proven, which is how, you know, I'm sure, you know, every single one of us has tried to use one of these websites during, you know, one of these cycles and the website goes down, right? Mm. That's because even the tried and true kind of Web2 solutions are failing, right? Because of the load, because of all the data that's going in between the users and the in the end, at the end, the full nodes that let's say Coinbase is running.
So just to really simplify this for I suppose for my own mind, there's this the way I think about this is the following, and please tell me if this is wrong. Most people think about a public ledger as mainly dealing with transactions. So like I submit a transaction to the ledger, and then that the ledger then verifies that that's correct, and that gets added to the state. But actually, in terms of the number of requests that come across, that's the smallest percentage part of it. Actually, a lot of things are querying state. So like, what is my balance? Has this transaction gone through? What addresses are associated with this transaction? What's the history of this token or this coin? And all of those things are not actually rewarded by the public ledgers themselves. Like, you know, if you're running a full Bitcoin node, you don't get rewarded for servicing 10,000 requests an hour for updating the balance information for someone. You don't get paid for the bandwidth that takes, but that does actually consume real bandwidth and have real costs. And you're talking about the website analogy. Like, that is essentially what a website is doing. A server is put up on a website. It has a web address. That web address is when addressed by a browser is being pinged. The DNS then looks up the IP address to the server. The server then returns the information that was requested by the browser. And most servers can deal with around, you know, 2,000 requests, simultaneous sessions before they fall over. And what we're talking about here is a similar problem, where you essentially have two sets of problems. You've got the validation of updates to state as one set of problems, and then you've got the second set of an order of problems that a lot of people don't really think about, which is, well, there's this request layer that needs to exist to even be able to do the transactions in the first place, even to be able to go, oh, I would like to send a Bitcoin transaction. Well, to do that, you need to know what your balance is. And actually, with Bitcoin, even more than that, you need to know what the UTXOs you can spend are. And then you need to be able to encapsulate those in a transaction and submit them back to the ledger. And all of that requires all of these requests that are not incentivized by the network natively. And as a result, you often can't expect to just be able to ping any node on the Bitcoin ledger and it to respond to you with like a random request for information, especially if it thinks that it's not necessarily going to make any money from doing that.
Exactly. Yeah. And it really depends on the website, because most websites don't even allow you to connect to your own node. There are some, you know, if you've ever used MetaMask, they actually let you connect to your own Ethereum node if you're running, you know, if you're running in a home server on some cloud or something like that. Some websites allow you, but I'd say 99% of them just don't, just for UX purposes, right? Like, you know, why add more of this kind of complexity, right? Sure. So now we live in a world now where, you know, a handful of companies are serving most of the data for many of the applications that we use today, mm-hmm. right? Which has kind of created this centralization point right above the kind of core protocols, right? Which, you know, philosophically is kind of a big reason we exist.
So the ledger may be trustless, but because of the difficulty in running a full node, you end up having to interface with trusted companies so that you can actually use the crypto that you own, or use the ledgers that you want to access, which ends up concentrating that request layer in the hands of brands that people recognize and trust because of this problem of, well, you could just swap out an address, or you could do something that would mean that I fundamentally end up getting my funds lost or stolen or something like that. So we need to trust at the moment people like Coinbase and people and other people who run and wallets that run full nodes and put themselves out there as a trusted entity to help you access your crypto.
Exactly right. That's exactly right. And, you know, philosophically, that's really, you know, a big reason why it exists. Pragmatically, it's also expensive to run full nodes. You know, going back to the Coinbase example, right? It's if I'm running two Bitcoin full nodes for every, you know, 1,000 or even 100,000 users, right? It's incredibly expensive because you're having to guarantee uptime, right? So that my website doesn't go down. You have to have backups. And just running a full node today is so expensive, right? You know, I talked about the size of these, just the one full node. You have to have backups on multiple, you know, cloud environments. So from Amazon Web Services to Google Cloud to Azure to whoever it might be, I need to be able to run backups. And as a result, it's actually much more expensive to run kind of scalable full node infrastructure for a centralized blockchain company than it would be for a traditional kind of Web2 company. Because just to talk about the scale here, one company back in 2017, 2018, and even today, we're doing 10 billion requests a day. And that's just one infrastructure company servicing 10 billion requests a day. If I had to guess what kind of in aggregate the entire industry is doing, I'd say it's probably between 500 billion and a trillion requests a day, right. Conservatively. Right. Right. And that's a lot of servers running in the cloud. And as a result, it's incredibly expensive.
Right.
So if I'm spending, you know, $10 million a year on kind of, you know, the primary servers, you can expect that that same company is spending another $5 million a year on top of that just to ensure that they have the backups ready so that my users can, you know, access the blockchain that they're accessing. And fundamentally, Pockets architecture, because it's distributed and decentralized, completely removes the need for that cost. So this is kind of the kind of big thesis behind Pocket is infrastructure is a commodity. And by fundamentally having an architecture that is much more cost effective, we can provide the same service at a fraction of the cost of even what centralized entities can do. So let's
go into what Pocket does a bit then. So your sort of a pitch is essentially, you know, all the entities that are currently running full nodes right now for their users, be they exchanges or crypto wallets or websites like CoinMarketCap or blockchain explorers or decentralized exchanges or aggregation services, all of these entities that constantly need to query blockchain data, you don't need to pay to run your own infrastructure directly. You can instead rely on a secondary network specifically designed for query requests, which is Pocket, right?
Exactly right. One could say it's an API as a protocol, if you will.
So how can I, like this whole trust but don't trust verify thing, how can I be sure that what Pocket serves me is trustworthy enough versus running my own node?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, if I'm running my own full node, right, I'm querying that one node, and I, you know, since I own it, I can, you know, be sure that the data that, you know, I haven't tampered with it, right? Mm-hmm. The question is, you know, if I'm querying, you know, a random node around the world, right? Because Pocket right now has nodes running from Australia to New Zealand to Moscow to Europe to you know, the Americas. How can I trust that that data has the integrity for my application? And part of the magic behind Pocket is I'm actually querying five nodes at once. And I could even query 5 or 10 or 20 or you know, whatever it might be to, you know, depending on the security I need for my application. But fundamentally, I have 5 random nodes and they all respond independently with the request. So let's say, what's my balance, right? And kind of the magic behind Pocket is that all of those nodes are financially on the line for providing good data. Mm-hmm. So when an application queries 5 nodes and 4 come back with an answer of 15, mm-hmm. and the fifth one comes back with an answer of 20, mm-hmm. That node that gave some bad information is subject to be burned or slashed or their money deleted by the protocol. And fundamentally, that's at the protocol level specifically. So That's how you can make, you can get guarantees.
At the pocket protocol level.
Correct. Sorry. Yes. At the pocket protocol level. And so that's how an application can get guarantees on the integrity of the data that they're getting. And effectively, you can ratchet up the security by increasing the amount of nodes that you're querying at any one point in time.
Right. So to break that down a bit more, there's a protocol, the pocket protocol, that all nodes that want to provide this query layer, this API for blockchains to end users and to companies, that all of these nodes are running. And much like a consensus system, like Ethereum or Bitcoin, there is a way in which these nodes can agree on whether or not someone is being dishonest and punish that person for doing that. So everyone is running, is it a blockchain?
Yeah, Pocket is its own independent blockchain. So it's meant to solve this one problem really well. It's not a smart contract platform. It's an application-specific blockchain meant to ensure redundant, cost-efficient infrastructure for your applications.
So I suppose there's a load of questions that come up behind that, which is how do you guys deal with throughput? Because if I've got many millions of requests per day or per hour, how do you make sure that the network is constantly in sync and that dishonest actors are caught and punished quickly enough?
Absolutely. Yeah. So what's interesting about Pocket is that while it is a blockchain, it actually stores as little as possible on the actual chain. So when you were explaining how the integrity of the data is ensured, it's a relationship between the application and the nodes it's querying. So it's a signature game where the application signs with the Pocket private keys saying, hey, I'm requesting my balance. And just as normal web scale kind of service, mm-hmm. The node can then respond immediately, hey, here's your balance. Mm-hmm. The trick is that nodes don't receive the reward until a few hours later. So what happens is all of these requests happen off chain, and all the node does is submit one transaction to the Pocket blockchain saying, hey, I did a million requests in the last hour. And that is very, very little data that actually gets submitted to the Pocket blockchain, because it would just be completely infeasible if a node was submitting every single API request. You know, we've designed Pocket to scale to frankly quadrillions of requests a day. And if nodes were submitting every single one of the transactions to the Pocket blockchain, that would just be, that's impossible. That's quite literally impossible. So the node just submits one simple transaction, and that's proof of the game between the application and that individual node. And what happens is a couple blocks later in the Pocket blockchain, that transaction that the node submitted gets proven through a set of cryptographic, through a zero knowledge range proof that is native to the Pocket blockchain, saying, hey, this node did the work that they said they did. And if that node maybe submitted one extra transaction or said they did something with someone that didn't actually happen, what ends up happening is that node gets their pocket that they used to access the network burned or slashed with it native to the protocol. So what happens is all this work happens off the Pocket blockchain. Mm-hmm. And what's great is that gets compressed into one really quite small transaction once an hour in the Pocket blockchain. And that's how we're able to scale so greatly, because you mentioned consensus, and it's actually not the nodes reaching consensus. It's actually the nodes reaching agreement with the application,
right,
and the application actually saying, hey, right, you know, these five nodes have, you know, been consistent with the information that they sent me.
They've all told me the same thing.
Yes, exactly.
And
exactly.
So it's actually, you're actually pushing the decision on whether or not nodes are being honest or dishonest onto the application rather than onto the network itself.
Precisely.
Very interesting. Okay, so like, why is using Pocket cheaper? Then, so I suppose let's have a little talk about what currently exists as competing solutions. I think the main one that most people will be familiar with is Infura from Ethereum, right? Where you have these like infrastructure as a service. I don't have to necessarily actually spin up, like I don't have to instantiate in AWS my own instance of the Ethereum, of an Ethereum node, and like get it all synced up and everything like that. I can kind of just pay for some instances on Infura that are my instances that I can then go and query if I want to, and I can change how they function and if I want to as well, and you know that. But ultimately, I can kind of guarantee a level of service for myself via that mechanism.
Yeah, exactly. So it takes 30 seconds to sign up for, you know, a service like Infura, and they have been a core piece of the Ethereum ecosystem in this capacity because, you know, it's very easy and quick to do it. But if you think about kind of the architecture of a service like Infura to operate at the scale that they are operating at, which is in the tens of billions of requests a day, they have to use cloud services like Amazon Web Services, for example. Mm-hmm. And when a service like Infura uses Amazon Web Services, they are paying rent to AWS. And if you've ever used a service like AWS as a company, it's not uncommon to have a server bill where you're like, whoa, where'd this come from? because frankly, it's expensive. And the skills you need to kind of optimize these things are, you know, are few and far between, to be honest. So that's the first piece, is you already have a middleman between a middleman, if you will, where you're running these services on, you know, to operate at the scale, right? They, Infura can't justify buying a data center or multiple data centers, having a global, you know, presence, you know, in Europe or in Asia, in the US, et cetera, et cetera. It makes sense to use a service like Amazon Web Services. So that's right. The first piece. So they're already paying rent to AWS. And the other piece is, like I mentioned before, Infura is bearing the cost of running these full nodes as well. And since these full nodes are so bulky and huge now, you know, where an Ethereum archival node or is on the order of, you know, 1.5 terabytes, it's on the order of, you know, $500 a month to run an archival node, right? Mm. And when you're running dozens of them, that gets very expensive very quickly. And then when you're having, you know, at this point, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people refreshing their wallets, right, or accessing some DeFi protocol, that's a lot of data that they're having to pay for. So what ends up happening is that it's fundamentally inefficient and expensive for them to operate the service. And that cost is borne by the developer paying for the service. So Infura is a traditional SaaS business, software as a service. You pay a monthly fee and they rate limit the amount of, you know, queries that your application can do. Right. When your application reaches a new tier, you're paying, you know, you might be paying $500 a month, you know, $1,000 a month. And, you know, that's their business model. The difference, the major difference in architecture with Pocket is a couple things. And one more thing. Sorry. To ensure uptime for the service, Infura also has to have these backups, which, again, you know, I have to have multiple full nodes to serve one user, say 1.5 full nodes actually to service a user. So if I'm spending, you know, $10 million a year on infrastructure on my primary set, you can add about $5 million of additional costs just to ensure, you know, 99.9% uptime for my users.
Sure.
So that kind of cost structure, you know, is borne by the developer building, you know, whatever DeFi application. There's a couple differences in Pocket. One, because we have hundreds of nodes already running in the network, when one node goes down, there's hundreds ready to replace it. So there is already that kind of extra cost of the backups of what we call redundancy is gone in Pocket because it's integrated into the protocol. So
right.
A server, a node runner in Pocket doesn't have to run a backup because there's already an entire network there backing them up. So if their internet goes down, lightning strikes, whatever it might be,
right.
There's hundreds of nodes ready to replace it, removing that cost from the actual node itself,
right.
from the infrastructure provider. So already that cost is gone. The other important piece is that in time, you can actually think of Pocket more like a proof of work protocol in this respect, where kind of like Bitcoin, where you've seen people, switch from running, you know, full nodes in their home, or mining Bitcoin in their homes to to full data centers, right? Or people purchase, you know, massive data centers all around the world to mine Bitcoin, because that's the most cost effective way to do it. In Pocket, the architecture is it's kind of inversed, where instead of people running these nodes from their home, currently they're running them from the cloud, actually. So people running them on Amazon Web Services, Google Cloud, whatever it might be. In Pocket, it's actually much more cost effective to run it out of a local data center, completely removing that need to have to pay rent to Amazon Web Services, for example. So it's much more cost effective for me to buy my own server, spend, you know, $1,000 on a good server, and use that to, you know, effectively mine Pocket, as opposed to paying Amazon Web Services for it. So those two kind of architectural differences are what, frankly, make Pocket significantly cheaper to run and significantly cheaper to access for developers specifically.
And I think that the thing that someone might level at you there, like the first blush on that, is, well, you know, with Infura, I've only got one backup, so I'm only paying for one backup. But with Pocket, I've got hundreds of backups, so that sounds more expensive. But the way that to actually think about this is, it's shared infrastructure. So you have in Infura, I have one piece of infrastructure per client, which means that I can have thousands and thousands of nodes as a result, because I got thousands and thousands of clients. But the usage of that is very uneven. Some of those will be maxing out their requests and all that kind of stuff, and others of them won't be. And there's still all of this redundancy that sits behind here. What Infura is doing is basically going, well, instead of having one dedicated client with one dedicated backup per customer that needs this sort of query layer, what we're doing is we're basically saying, well, let's have a decentralized network of hundreds of nodes, and the query requests will be spread across this network, so that you end up getting this sort of very neat auto leveling of load across the network. That means that all nodes in the network are being used at approximately the same level of capacity as all other nodes.
Exactly right. And as a result, you know, you don't have to pay for backups, for example. I know roughly how much node, you know, how much work my node is going to do, since, as you said, the protocol load balances or splits the work up evenly across the entire, all of the nodes running on Pocket.
So how is Pocket security actually work? Like, you got a proof of stake algorithm? Like, what's actually happening there? How's the Pocket token work?
Yeah. So I said Pocket, you know, economically, you want to conceptually think of actually more close to a proof of work blockchain, because I get paid for every request that I do as a node. But the way that the state is protected on the chain itself is through proof of stake. And every node that is staking in Pocket is also contributing to the security of the network by participating in proof of stake consensus. And the way the rewards are split up is about 89% of the work that I do, of the reward, goes to the node that did it. 1% goes to the proof of stake consensus block producer. So that's not, it's very similar to, you know, when I'm a Bitcoin miner and I get chosen to create a block. The difference is the Bitcoin miner gets the full block reward in Pocket. The chosen block producer gets 1% of the block reward in this case. And that is what it secures the integrity of the chain over the as a whole. So, and then the other 10% goes to, you know, a DAO that you know, gets managed by the protocol, and so on and so forth. But fundamentally, the way that state gets protected is through proof of stake. We haven't invented our own proof of stake algorithm or anything like that. If you've heard of Cosmos, they use a consensus mechanism called Tendermint. And that's something we're seeing that at this point, dozens of protocols, it's actually the Cosmos ecosystem is growing quite rapidly. But, you know, for us, we wanted to use the most kind of well-tested consensus mechanism at the time. And that was Cosmos for us, because they had already launched their blockchain and had seen some smoothness and success and kind of the, you know, the stability of the protocol, right? So, sure. So
I mean, I certainly wouldn't say it's the most tested consensus algorithm, but it's certainly got some interesting new features. I mean, like, obviously the Ethereum's consensus algorithm has had a more extensive testing than the newer ones.
Of course. I mean, yeah, Ethereum is proof of work. Yeah. I mean, proof of stake chains are still a relatively new concept. So, you know, the longer these are up, you know, at the time they were the most well tested for what we were looking for, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Because they've done a really great job in building this in a way where, you know, many protocols can use the same consensus independently, right?
Yeah. And with regards to just take me through some statistics of your network at the moment. How many nodes do you have?
Yeah. So we launched mainnet on July 28th. And right now we're hovering right around 190, 200 nodes are on the network. And this is a global set of nodes from Moscow to Australia to, you know, the Americas and so on and so forth. And they today are serving somewhere between 1 million and 2 million requests a day, which is pretty incredible. The fact that we've got this blockchain that is coordinating infrastructure at a global scale trustlessly. It's actually quite just remarkable to see. So
it's really awesome.
And, you know, we see it as a marketplace, right? So, you know, developers pay for Pocket to access the network. And nodes also pay for Pocket to have the right of doing work in the network. And you've got a kind of circular two-sided marketplace here where the inflation of the network is completely dependent on the work that gets done. And you have both sides accessing the network for their own reasons, right? But it's been really great. We support Pocket natively, of course. So we have a couple Pocket applications that are, of course, running on Pocket, like a Block Explorer and a wallet and that sort of thing. And then we also support Ethereum today. So I'd say 80 to 90% of our traction is going through Ethereum. Though one important piece about Pocket is that it's blockchain agnostic. So we're kind of, you know, about that middleware. You can just put it in front of any full node and quite simply provide access and incentives for any other native chain.
And in terms of the usage so far, what kind of applications have you guys started to work with, and what kind of request data are you dealing with at the moment?
Yeah, so our bread and butter are wallets and block explorers. In fact, you could put in a Pocket URL in your MetaMask today and access the network. So by doing that, you're actually providing an incentive for people to run full nodes for Ethereum, which is pretty impactful, actually.
Do I need to have Pocket to do that?
No, you don't actually. So the way the protocol is designed, instead of paying fees directly to the nodes like you would a SaaS business, developers stake Pocket once. And by staking Pocket once, that is what gives you some allocated, you know, throughput or access. So, you know, instead of paying $50 a month for, you know, 100,000 requests a day, I might stake, you know, $200 worth of Pocket for the same access, as an example. The key piece with kind of this MetaMask URL is that we, as a company, are staking on your behalf. Mm-hmm. And because of that design, we can actually abstract the entire need for users to ever even know we exist at that point, which is really impactful, you know, harkening back to kind of Coinbase, right? Like, it's important for that user experience as well for us to reach some real success here. So
what would I expect to see as a difference in experience from the point of view of a user if I go from using the current MetaMask sort of query nodes, which are provided by MetaMask, to selecting the Pocket network as the query ledger? What would I expect to see as a difference to my user experience?
Yeah, you wouldn't notice much difference at all, right? So we're talking on the order here of hundreds of milliseconds. Mm. So, you know, one of the trade-offs, to be fair, is you are accessing a global set of nodes on Pocket. So one of the efficiencies of a centralized system is that they can say, hey, look, you know, I'm in Australia, let me provide a server that's closer to you so that you're not taking forever to load something, right? And so the difference here is where, you know, you might get a load in 200 milliseconds, right? Or a fifth of a second. Pocket might be, you know, at 300, 400 or 500 milliseconds, an example. But in the grand scheme of things, you know, depending on the application, it's negligible in terms of the speed. So that is because you're accessing a global set of nodes, right? That said, What's interesting about Pocket is that, you know, we have hundreds of nodes running today. We designed the protocol to, frankly, have tens of thousands of nodes. And once we reach a critical mass in nodes, we'll be able to sort by location. So imagine Pocket Americas, Pocket EU, Pocket, you know, Asia, Pocket, you know, wherever it might be, we can actually sort by location in the future as well. But of course, you know, this is, you know, these are the kind of trade-offs we've made early on, you know, where an application might be happy to cut their server bill by 20, 30, 40 grand a month for that trade-off today. So that's kind of the big difference right now.
Super interesting. Okay, so if people want to get involved, how can they get involved? What can people do right now on the Pocket Network? And who do you want joining? Who do you want to talk to?
Yeah, at this point, I mean, anyone can contribute to Pocket by just, you know, for example, if you're just browsing DeFi on a daily basis, we've got a blog post that you can just add the, it gives you, you know, it'll take you 30 seconds to add a add our MetaMask link to your daily browsing. That just immediately contributes to more people running full nodes. At a lower level, our community is quite strong on our Discord. So if you're keen on learning more about the protocol, contributing yourself, either as a developer or a node runner, and whether you're, you know, technical or non-technical, it doesn't make a difference. We've walked people through through setting up their own nodes regardless. So I'd say our Discord, which you can find on our website, or through our Twitter, which is at P-O-K-T Network, is where you can definitely keep up with what we're doing.
And if they want to run a Pocket node, is that something that people can do?
Absolutely. Yeah. That's kind of what's really interesting about an open source protocol like Pocket, because the kind of secret sauce or competitive advantage of these kind of centralized infrastructure providers is kind of their closed source infrastructure setups. What Pocket is doing is actually breaking this up and, frankly, making it easier for people to run these sorts of infrastructure. You know, we're not quite there yet, but in not too distant future, you'll be able to run, you know, your own full nodes with a couple clicks in the future. So that's a really interesting thing about how these open source incentives work, right? We can collectively gain economies of scale through this open source software, which is really impactful. So yeah, you know, if you want to run a full node, I'd say come into our Discord, ask some questions, we'll point you in the right direction either way.
That's awesome. Michael, thank you so much for coming on the show. Been a real pleasure talking with you.
Thank you for having me, Pierce.